Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining me today on the Human History Podcast. I am excited to be back at it after a bit of a break. I hope everyone is staying safe and healthy out there. Our subject today is of a people who established what is widely considered to be the first great empire ever to rise out of the collection of city-states which had begun to establish themselves in the Fertile Crescent of ancient Mesopotamia, possibly the first true empire in all of human history. Today we're talking about the Akkadians, whose empire dominated the Mesopotamian plain for about 200 years, starting in 2334 BC. Before they were an empire, though, these people were simply a collection of tribes from the west and south who shared a common Semitic language. They began slowly moving into the Sumerian plain sometime during the beginning of the 3rd millennium BC, and by the 23rd century, BC would see one of their own become king of the four quarters, quote unquote. This empire began from humble beginnings, as the stories like to say, with a man named Sargon, originally Sharrumkin, which was shortened to Sharkin and translated into Hebrew as Sargon, which translates to legitimate king, which already tells you a little something right there. Sargon's true past is a mystery to us, but his fame led to the growth of legends surrounding his birth and his upbringing. These tales were completely unknown to us until the late 19th century, when archaeologist Sir Henry Rawlinson printed The Legend of Sargon, which he had discovered in the excavation of the ancient library of 7th century Assyrian king Ashurbanipal. Here's an excerpt from the story, translated from ancient cuneiform. My mother was a changeling. My father I knew not. The brother of my father loved the hills. My home was in the highlands, where the herbs grow. My mother conceived me in secret. She gave birth to me in concealment. She set me in a basket of rushes. She sealed the lid with tar. She cast me into the river, but it did not rise over me. The water carried me to Aki, the drawer of water. He lifted me out as he dipped his jar into the river. He took me as his son. He raised me. He made me his gardener. So, the basic storyline may sound a little familiar. This type of tale has been spun in literature and theater for thousands of years. Sargon's story, though, is the earliest of these type of tales that we know of. So exactly who raised Sargon is unclear, but sources have Sargon finding himself in the court of King Urzababa of the 4th dynasty of Kish around the late middle part of the 24th century BC, with some sources claiming he was raised by the palace gardener, and some others claiming he was raised by one of Urzababa's chief governors who appointed him to work in the gardens. As one story goes, Sargon was visited one day in the fields by the goddess Inanna, who blessed him with her favor. And sometime after this, said that Urzababa had a dream, which led him to appoint the young man who'd grown up in the gardens as his cupbearer. Now, in ancient Mesopotamia, a cupbearer is equivalent to a most trusted advisor, and the most powerful man in the city besides the king himself, from what I can tell. So during and leading up to the time Sargon is acting as Urzababa's right-hand man, a man named Lugalzagesi, who's the king of Uma, is taking his forces around the southern Mesopotamian plain and bringing its cities under his control, subjugating its minor rulers, or Ensi, and according to some sources, managing to establish a fairly unified proto-empire. Sources are a bit mixed on whether Urzababa was a part of this unified collection of city-states, or whether Kish remained independent until Lugalzagesi's attack The latter seems the most supported theory. But after taking Uruk, which if you recall was probably the first city in human history and certainly the largest in Mesopotamia for hundreds of years, Lugal Zaggisi did finally turn his attention on Kish and Urzababa. By this time, Urzababa was already becoming a little wary of his cupbearer. It's also said that he'd had dreams involving the goddess Inanna, which made him fear his favor was slipping with her while Sargon's was rising. I think the story is something about Urzababa having a dream where he was drowning in a river of blood, which he knew to be in relation of Inanna somehow. Stories aren't entirely clear. At one point, there is also a story that says he apparently attempted to have Sargon assassinated by his chief smith, but that obviously did not work. After that, he attempted to strike a deal with Lugal Zaggisi to have Sargon killed during negotiations for peace as Lugal Zaggisi was marching up towards Kish. It's unclear exactly how everything transpired. What is clear is Lugal Zaggisi did not kill Sargon. Instead, he marched on and conquered Kish. While this was happening, though, Sargon was making moves of his own. He'd gathered forces behind him and struck at Uruk, taking the city from Lugal Zaggisi's control. Uncertainties from the fact that some sources claim Sargon joined Lugal Zaggisi to take Kish, while others claim he just went straight on to Uruk, and then others claim that actually both of them happened, just one after the other. Either way, when he heard what had happened at Uruk, Lugal Zaggisi rode out to meet Sargon in the field. He was soundly defeated, though, and Sargon dragged the would-be empire builder back to Kish, where he declared himself king. Some sources claim Sargon marched Lugal Zaggisi in chains through the gates of the sacred city of Nippur, the city of his chosen god Enlil. Either way, it's likely that wherever Sargon brought Lugal Zaggisi, he was executed on that spot. Once in complete control, Sargon declared Ishtar, who's also known as Inanna, as his protector god. Following his decree, Sargon began a sweep south with his army, winning battles, subjugating minor kings, those Ensi that we mentioned before, bringing territory under his sway. Some sources have him winning upwards of 34 battles, subjugating over 50 Ensi. In an effort to separate himself from the Sumerian leaders of the past and establish a genuinely new rule, Sargon had a new capital built, the city of Akkad, translated as Akkad. The year was 2334 BC, and the Akkadian Empire had begun. The task of building the world's first true empire was made a bit easier by the fact that Lugal Zaggisi had already laid a lot of the groundwork in his efforts to tame the Sumerian plain. Much of Sumer was already united under one rule, and in a story it seems as old as civilization, the lower class had become fed up with the hoarding of resources and land grabs made by the elites. Even so, with much of the Sumerian people used to being under one ruler, and many of them disillusioned with that rule, Sargon still faced rebellions from within. These he saw to with a military strength that likely had not been seen in the entire world to this point. And I want to take a minute here to talk about an aspect of ancient Mesopotamian society that might help us to understand how these empires, how first those mini empires, those proto-empires, and then eventually the great Akkadian Empire, how they form in the context of these societies. So if you were to imagine yourself as an ancient citizen of the city of Kish. Your patron god is the chief of the gods, actually, Enlil. Other cities have different patron gods who are all part of the same pantheon, and individuals can seek favor from different gods for different reasons. But the patron god of a city watches over it, and it's the ultimate source for all occurrences, essentially. Now, as a citizen of Kish, you also have a king. This king is not like British kings of the early British monarchy, whose claim of royal blood inspired fierce hereditary loyalty among citizens. Instead, while kings in ancient Mesopotamia claimed the favor of the gods, it was more in the way that their ascension had proved that they had the favor of the gods. For the king, it's a precarious position to be in. As long as things are going well, you have your crops are producing, trade is going smoothly and bringing in goods from around the region and further afield, life is generally good. It's obvious to you as a citizen of Kish that Enlil favors this king and their rule. If, however, a king from the south named Lugal Zaghessi comes to your city's gates, and the city is either surrendered or won in battle by this new king, this is clear proof that Enlil no longer favors the old king, and instead favors Lugal Zaghessi. From that point on, as long as the crops yield food and markets have things to be traded, there's not really reason for you to consider Lugal Zaghessi anything other than a legitimate king who has the favor of Enlil. You can see how this helps in building empires. There isn't much of a need to win over the local populations, as winning itself accomplishes this, all in one fell swoop, essentially. It's not to say that there were no political factions. On the contrary, dealing with those who occupied the administrative duties under a particular ruler was one of the most sensitive areas of taking over another's territory. Unlike the Sumerian conquerors before him, who chose a path of least resistance when it came to local governors and temple officials, allowing many of them to remain in place while paying tribute and loyalty to the king, Sargon began a process of completely insinuating his people into the lands he conquered through appointments of local governors and even installing his daughter as the high priestess of the moon god of Ur. From the legend of Sargon, quote, "From the sea above to the sea below, the sons of Akkad held the chiefdoms of his cities," end quote. So this strategy has its benefits, as while he put his own people into these positions, he showed respect for the local deities, paying tribute to almost everyone he came across in his expansion. If you remember, in ancient Mesopotamia, respecting the gods was almost always a good idea. As a ruler, Sargon seems to have been extraordinarily effective, and not only in his military capabilities. Under the stability of the empire he created, large infrastructure projects were carried out, with an increase in the building of roads and the improvement and expansion of irrigation techniques. The Akkadian Empire is also responsible for the earliest postal service, with messages being written on clay tablets and then wrapped and sealed in clay with a seal added for the recipient before being hearted. The recipient could then break open the clay envelope, quote-unquote envelope, and read the tablet. He also expanded the trade network of his empire while expanding its military reach further than any previous Mesopotamian ruler. In addition to this, Sargon developed standardized weights and measures to be used in trade and daily commerce, and instituted what's generally regarded to be a fair tax system. He also seems to have fostered a society in which arts and culture were nurtured. His own daughter, Enheduanna, is widely recognized as the earliest named author in human history, and apparently was quite a capable administrator in her own right. To ensure control of this vast new expanse of territory, Sargon built what was likely the first professional standing army in human history. Prior to this time, the ancient cities of Sumer were protected by a militia-type assembly of citizens who would be called upon in a time of need, such as an attack on the city from a neighbor or from raiding nomads, for example. Sargon seems to have been the first to specifically employ professional full-time soldiers en masse, which could not only defend the empire from external attacks, but also be used to put down rebelling cities, whose militias were really not a match for the skill and size of his professional force. So while they may have been the first, they were by no means primitive. The Akkadian military would go on to develop tactics used for thousands of years through the time of Alexander the Great, almost 2,000 years later. Using this professional army, Sargon would range north and east, claiming territories and adding subjects to his growing empire. The exact amount of land that would have been within his boundaries during his reign is difficult to say, with clay tablets from the period likely being exaggerated to some extent. At the very least, as we said, Sargon controlled more territory than any previous Mesopotamian ruler. His empire, which encompassed the Sumerian-speaking city-states of the plain and the Akkadian-speaking population of Mesopotamia, truly represented the world's first multinational empire. So Sargon would rule for around 55 years, depending on who you ask, 55, 56 years, and he likely died due to old age. His death meant the ascension of his son, Ramush, to the throne. And upon taking control, Ramush was immediately faced with a five-city rebellion, which we'll see is a common theme during Akkadian transfers of power, and really, transfers of power during this ancient Mesopotamian time. That generally very fragile, lots of violence and hostilities during these times. We'll see Ramush was able to successfully quash these uprisings and maintained order in the empire. During his short reign, seems to have accomplished some modest gains in the empire's territory while continuing to maintain the order which allowed the empire to begin flourishing under Sargon in the first place. Unfortunately, seems Ramush had made some enemies. His death came at the hands of palace servants who conspired to assassinate him, which brought his younger brother Manishtushu to the throne. Manishtushu's involvement in the plot isn't known as far as I know, but if you immediately assumed he had something to do with it, you probably would not be alone. Manishtushu's reign ended up lasting about 14 years, and for most sources consisted of little worth noting. A few victories he claimed and territories he brags of conquering were likely subjugated under his brother Ramush. Manishtushu can be best remembered for giving birth to his son, Naram-Sin, would grow up to become the most prolific ruler in the Akkadian Empire's history, and therefore one of the greatest rulers from all of ancient Mesopotamia. Naram-Sin, like his grandfather, displayed extraordinary leadership abilities. Not only did he expand the boundaries of the empire to include an area unmatched by later Mesopotamian rulers for centuries, he did so while leading the military campaigns from the front lines. This was common among these Akkadian rulers, but Naram-Sin seems to have been a particularly skilled warrior. And he was a warrior, but he was also adept at maintaining control and order within the empire. And it's this combination of skills, which were displayed by Sargon and then exceeded by his grandson, Naram-Sin, that the Akkadian Empire was able to reach its pinnacle. During this period, which for context, Naram-Sin's rule is thought to be from approximately 2260 BC to around 2220 BC, give or take a few years, depending on the source. But during this period, the empire reached as far as modern-day Turkey in the north and west, inner Iran in the east, and Arabia in the south, and as far as the Mediterranean in the west. His rule is significant not just for his achievements in solidifying the greatness of the empire as a whole, but in the shift he made in reference to himself. Naram-Sin made himself a god. One of the most remarkable and striking artifacts from the ancient world, today on display at the Louvre in France, reflects the very moment in time that Naram-Sin made this shift, with the commissioning of a clay tablet known as a victory stele, which shows the king's victory over a mountain tribe people to the east known as the Lulubi and their king Satuni. The victory stele of Naram-Sin, as it's officially called, is thought to have been carved out sometime around the end of his reign, or just slightly afterwards. Diverging from the style of previous victory steles, which were normally divided into horizontal bands depicting the battle at different levels, for example, with regular soldiers being on a lower level, the king and his coterie on another, and the gods being on top, the stele is oriented vertically. The victory stele of Naram-Sin is oriented vertically, and there's no bands on it, really, per se. It shows the ancient ruler ascending a mountain and trampling over his enemies as he makes his way to the peak, which is looked over by two celestial objects, which look like suns or stars. Naram-Sin is depicted in the image of a god. You can see, if you look up the image, that Naram-Sin is depicted much larger than all the other figures, and his helmet is an ornate piece with two curved horns originating from the sides and pointing to the heavens. And this helmet, this garment with the horns on it, is something that was really only seen attributed to the gods up to this point. And along with that, along the same lines, it's about this time he began marking his name with a sign designating himself as a god. Naram-Sin reigned for about 36 years, from 2254 to around 20, like we said, to around 2220, give or take a few years on either end. In that time, he was able to expand the boundaries of his empire while developing far-reaching trade relationships and continuing the tradition of supporting the arts and culture within the Akkadian territories. He is generally regarded by modern scholars to be one of, if not the, greatest rulers in all of ancient Mesopotamia. In its entry on Naram-Sin, the Ancient History Encyclopedia quotes Sumerologist Samuel Noah Kramer, who I think sums up the reign of Naram-Sin quite nicely. Naram-Sin raised a god to new heights of power and glory. His military successes were numerous and prodigious. He defeated a powerful coalition of rebellious kings from Sumer and the surrounding lands. He conquered the region to the west as far as the Mediterranean Sea and Taurus and Amanus ranges. He extended his dominion into Armenia and erected his Statue of Victory near modern Diyarbakir. He fought the Lulubi in the northern Zagros ranges and commemorated his victory with a magnificent stele. He turned Elam into a partially Semitized vassal state and constructed numerous buildings in Susa. He brought booty from Magan after defeating its king, Menaim, who some scholars have identified with the renowned Menes of Egypt. No wonder that he felt himself powerful enough to add the epithet King of the Four Quarters to his titulary, and that he was presumptuous enough to have himself deified as the god of a god. Following a pretty remarkable reign, Naram-Sin died, again presumably of old age, and he passed the throne to his son, Shar-Kali-Shari. As with every Akkadian ruler before him, Shar-Kali-Shari was welcomed to the throne by way of rebellions inside and attacks from outside. The difference is he seems to have been much less adept at dealing with these problems, and he spent almost his entire reign at war with the Elamites in the east, the Amorites from the west, invading nomadic Gutians from the north. And I just want to say, I will be doing an episode on some of the various peoples that had a large impact on ancient Mesopotamia, including the Elamites, whose language is still a mystery to this day, and the Amorites, who are the tribe of Hammurabi, the first king of Babylon. So those episodes will be coming up. I know I've talked about the Elamites a lot, when we bring up the Amorites and a couple of other groups, so there will be some episodes coming up on those, so don't worry, we will get there. It seems to have been the Gutians, though, along with the changing climate, which brought widespread famine, whose raiding and destruction, which was unable to be checked, resulted in the eventual end of the Akkadian rule and plunged the region into a Mesopotamian Dark Age, which was later to be ended by the recognizable figures from the episode on Sumerians, Gudea, Utuhagal, and Ur-Nammu, and Shulgi. Through time, the events of Shar-Kali-Shari's reign would be mixed and mingled with the other Akkadian kings, used in fables for thousands of years. These stories were preserved on clay tablets that were eventually unearthed and found in the ruins of the 7th century Assyrian king Ashurbanipal's library, which we mentioned before. And all these stories, all these clay tablets, they'd been hidden under the rubble ever since the Medes and the Babylonians and the Persians destroyed the Assyrian cities during Ashurbanipal's reign in the 7th century. So one of the most popular of these stories, actually, that I would like to talk about, would show Naram-Sin not as a great ruler, but as an impious king whose actions against the gods would cost the Akkadian Empire everything. The Curse of a God, one of the fables discovered at Ashurbanipal's library, tells the tale of a man, who is Naram-Sin, whose city is stripped of favor by the chief of the gods, Enlil, and in so doing prevents any of the other gods from bestowing their favor on the city. Naram-Sin is confused by this, does not understand why Enlil has done such a thing, so he petitions the gods for an answer. After waiting 7 years for a response and hearing nothing, Naram-Sin, incensed, raises an army and storms and destroys the sacred tomb of Enlil in the sacred city of Nippur. A quote from the text reads that he, quote, sets his spades against its roots, his axes against the foundations until the temple, like a dead soldier, falls prostrate, end quote. This attack obviously upsets the gods, who respond by sending in the Gutium to attack Akkad. The tablets describe the Gutians as, quote, a people who know no inhibition with human instincts but canine intelligence and with monkey features, end quote. What follows is widespread famine and destruction and ultimately the end of the Akkadian Empire. When it was first discovered in the late 19th century, it was believed that the story came to us from the third dynasty of Ur, which reestablished the Sumerian presence on the plain after the nomadic invasion had thoroughly destroyed the Akkadian Empire. More modern scholars believe, though, that the story is from much later, with the author simply choosing Naram-Sin and the Akkadian Empire as examples in their attempt to paint a different picture about the proper relationship between monarchs and the gods. By all accounts, Naram-Sin honored the gods, placing himself alongside them rather than above them in the temples. The story stuck, though. For some later generations, Naram-Sin was associated with the downfall of an empire due to his impiety. So there were actually two kings that followed the death of Shar-Kali-Shari, Dudu and his son Shulgi-Turul, though they ruled only the area surrounding the capital city of Agad. The details surrounding the fall of the first great empire in human history are as mysterious today as they were when records of the Akkadians surfaced almost 400 years ago. The exact location of the capital city is still unknown, with only guesses and incomplete clues so far discovered. The lack of insight into the final days and overall fate of the Akkadians remains one of the biggest mysteries of the ancient Mesopotamian world. And even today, archaeologists continue the search for the lost city. The inability to locate it suggests to some that it was so thoroughly destroyed in the Gutian era that no trace of it was left behind to discover. At any rate, technological advances in data collection and analysis are changing the game. Might one day make it possible to detect the faintest clues of ancient civilizations in the rock and soil of the earth that once hosted them. But who knows? Despite our lack of understanding about what happened to the Akkadians in the end, what is clear is the empire begun by Sargon the Great around 2334 BC became the world's first truly multinational empire, and it was the first political entity to make extensive and efficient use of bureaucracy and administration on a large scale and set the standard for future rulers and kingdoms. And that's it. That's the story of the Akkadian Empire. Started by Sargon the Great, an orphan gardener's son, if the stories are to be believed, expanded and strengthened to its peak by his grandson, Naram-Sin, and eventually destroyed by the raiding Gutians when later rulers failed to maintain the vast reaches of the ancient superpower. That, along with strong evidence of a shift in the climate which caused widespread famine, to kind of wreak havoc on the entire area, which only made it easier for the raiding Gutians to really cause some damage. So, you know, it was about 200 years that the Akkadians were on the scene in ancient Mesopotamia, which, if you think about it, really constitutes just a minor blip on the timescale of human civilizations. But needless to say, this candle burned very brightly. Stories of the Akkadians have survived through thousands of years of conflict and climate to bring us closer to an understanding of how the ancient world built itself, how that ancient world built the modern one we all live in today. Lessons learned from rulers like Sargon and Naram-Sin are different for each person who chooses to delve into those lives. But the fact that we know of them at all, and know so much, is truly remarkable and incredible, and it's one of the reasons I find archaeology so absolutely fascinating and important. Revealing more about where we came from can only illuminate any path we choose to venture down in the future. And I think we'll find, as we continue on, that the ancients had much more to teach us about the modern world than we may have ever given them credit for. So thank you all so much for joining me today. And I hope you'll stay tuned for episodes coming up in the future. I'm looking forward to diving into what little we know about the Elamites an ancient civilization whose presence may have played as important a role in Mesopotamian history as any other, but who we know relatively little about, due in main part to the fact that their language has still yet to be deciphered. We'll also talk more about the Babylonians, descendant of the Amorites, and coming up soon after will be a series on the ancient Egyptians, which I'm thoroughly looking forward to. If you enjoy the show and you haven't already, please take a second to rate this show on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. It's a great way to let people know that you liked it. So have a good one and stay safe. And as always, be excellent to each other.